So I want to welcome you to the 431st meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Rockport, Maine. And I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and the factors influencing them. We are now nearing the end of our 36th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we are very pleased to have with us Ambassador Douglas Silliman, who will be speaking on Iraq after ISIS, caught between the United States and Iran. Ambassador Douglas Silliman is president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He retired from the Foreign Service in April of 2019, just this year, after 35 years of service. He served as ambassador to Iraq from 2016 until earlier this year in 2019, and as U.S. ambassador to Kuwait from 2014 to 2016. From 2013 to 2014, he served as senior advisor in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs in the U.S. Department of State, working on Iraq issues and the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. Ambassador Silliman was deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, Iraq, from 2012 to 2013, minister counselor for political affairs in Baghdad from 2011 to 2012, and the deputy chief of mission in Ankara, Turkey, from 2008 to 2011. So he knows his way around the Middle East. His other State Department positions include director of the Department of the State's Office of Southern European Affairs, political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Jordan, and the regional officer for the Middle East in the Office of the Coordinator for Counterterrorism. In 2018, Ambassador Silliman received the Presidential Distinctive Service Award from President Donald J. Trump. He has received numerous awards from the Department of State, including the Secretary's Award for Public Outreach in 2007, as well as many senior performance awards. In addition to his position as president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, Ambassador Silliman serves on the Board of Advisors of the bilateral U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce. This organization helps American businesses expand their international business and trade ties, especially in the Middle East and Gulf region. Ambassador Silliman received a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science, summa cum laude, from Baylor University in Texas, where he was also a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He earned a Master's of Arts in International Relations from the George Washington University. He speaks frequent Arabic and French, and just as last month when I commented on this, from conversations with him, I believe he also speaks very fluent English. Doug, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
George, thank you very much for the introduction. And if you'll all permit me, I want to start with a story. So it's the middle of the night, and it's pitch black in the safe house. And the ISIS militant gets up, as he's been instructed, and goes to the window to see if it's dark outside, if the moon has gone below the horizon. Seeing that it had, he creeps to the door. He walks out carefully from the little collection of houses where the safe house is located, and heads east across the desert, this undulating pancake of hardened dirt and dust. After walking a couple of kilometers, as he was told, he saw in the distance a larger village, and he remembers being told, you have to turn south, get away from that village, there's a police station there, you need to stay out of the way of the authorities. So he skirts around the edge of the village, and then he sees in the distance the main Baghdad-Mosul highway. And per his instructions, he turns to his right and walks south along that road for a couple of kilometers until he sees the road sign that says Baghdad 350 kilometers. Then he crawls on his hands and knees from his position a couple of hundred meters off the road right to the edge of the four-lane highway. And he waits there as he was told, to see if anybody's going to come. So he waits 5 minutes, 10 minutes. He says, this is safe. So he starts to get up, and then he sees headlights and a car speeding along the highway past him. He pushes himself back down to the dust, his heart pounding because he felt he almost got caught. So now he's terrified. And he crawls back down into the ditch by the side of the road and waits 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. He says, what am I going to do? God, help me. I've got to get to my destination tonight. After 20 minutes, he decides, I guess the road is safe. So he gets up and crouches and runs as quickly as he could across the four-lane highway, dives into the brush in the ditch on the other side. And as he was told, he continues walking east a couple more kilometers. At that point, he can begin to smell the water of the Tigris River mixing with the dust from the desert. And he says, I've almost gotten to my destination. And then he sees in the shadow of the distance a stand of trees and some rocks, just that as he was told would be there, and he heads for that. And when he gets to that stand of trees, right on the edge of the Tigris River, he's met by two men. They very quietly say, welcome, brother. We're going to help you get across. So he said, but where's the boat? I have to get to that island. He said, well, there are no more boats because the Americans have eyes in the sky and they can see the boats and they shoot at us when we use boats. And there's patrols along both sides of the river by the Iraqi army and the counterterrorism service that look for slips where boats could stay, and they make it very difficult for us. So brother, you're going to have to swim and float out to the island. So what they did is they gave him a plastic bag. He took off his clothes and his shoes, put them in the plastic bag, and they outfitted him with what can best be described as a vest, but it's really rope tied around a couple of empty bottles that are sealed closed, so that he, who didn't know how to swim because he grew up in the middle of the desert, could float safely with the current of the river down to the island. But they said, brother, you have to wait because they can still see you if you're swimming. You've got to wait for some piece of debris or log or something to float down the river, and then you just float down the river with that debris. So he gingerly puts his toes into the mud at the edge of the river and then submerges himself, and he's shocked by the coldness of the water. Even though it's early, early in the morning, it's still 100 degrees outside, and the water is chilling, and he is virtually naked. He submerges into the water and then sits and waits for something to float down the river. So again, 5 minutes go by, 10 minutes go by, and then he sees this little clump of a branch with some leaves on it that floats by. He says, I can do this. He pushes out into the river, grabs a hold of the branches, holds his breath, and puts his head down, tries to swim to the center of the channel so he can get to the island. So he floats with the half a kilometer down the river. He gets to the end of the island, and someone greets him and says, brother, welcome. You finally almost reached your destination, but we must dry you off, put on your clothes. So they march into the island, up to a clump of trees in the center, up a surprisingly large hill, he thinks, for the island. So after 10 minutes of walking, 15 minutes of walking, the man who met him said, brother, you're here. You can rest, and shows him a nice dry place between rocks with some tree covers. Now, this island in the Tigris River, about a quarter of the way between Mosul and Baghdad, is what many of us in the government and many in the press refer to as Hotel ISIS. It was a logistics base, a way station for ISIS militants who were transiting from Syria into the populated areas of Iraq, or transiting from Iraq back into Syria when they had another assignment, or when the pressure from the Iraqi army and the coalition was pushing them westward out of Iraq. And I mention this because the title of the talk that we had agreed upon a couple of months ago was Iraq After ISIS. But I have to say that on the 10th of September of 2019, the U.S. Air Force dropped 80,000 pounds of munitions on this island. And after the fires went out and the temperature of the island went down, the Iraqi counterterrorism service stormed the island on boats to make sure that there was nobody left alive and ISIS could never again use this island as a way station. And most ironically, the closest Iraqi base that had American forces was less than 10 miles away from this location. I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about Iraq. I've spent a lot of time in Iraq, 5 of the last 10 years. But I don't want to look at the history of Iraq. I want to look at the issues that are going to affect the success of the American project in Iraq and the Iraqi project in Iraq as we go forward. And there are three issues I want to talk to you about and give you indicators that you can watch and judge on the success of that project as we go forward. The first one is ISIS, whether or not ISIS will come back. The second one is Iran and how Iran has been able to insinuate itself into much of what is done inside Iraq. The third is a very fast-growing youth population which feels it does not have opportunities that their parents and grandparents had. So let's start with ISIS. ISIS sped across the desert from Syria into Iraq in the summer of 2014, and the Iraqi army, and many other aspects, the Iraqi police just collapsed in the face of ISIS because they had believed ISIS propaganda that ISIS was the caliphate built by God and that all the infidels who stood in their way would be destroyed. So in a couple of occasions, we heard the stories of the Iraqi army in an M1A1 Abrams main battle tank that was taken on by a white Toyota pickup truck with 5 guys with weapons in the back. And the tank crews, because they were so afraid of what they had heard from ISIS propaganda, simply abandoned their tanks and ran, where one shell could have taken out the entire ISIS raiding party. In this way, ISIS was able to move from Syria across northern Iraq and western Iraq virtually to the gates of Baghdad in less than 4 months. It was at that point, as they were nearing Baghdad, the Iranians came in. The Iranians helped provide some assistance to militias that they had previously formed in Iraq, and we'll talk more about that later. And the United States came in to help the Iraqi army stop ISIS at the gates of Baghdad and begin to push them back. Over the course of the next 3 years, the Iraqi army and Iraqi forces doing most of the work, little by little, village by village, kilometer by kilometer, pushed ISIS from Baghdad all the way back to the Syrian border. And then at the end of 2017, the Iraqi prime minister declared that the ISIS caliphate in Iraq was over. There were still many ISIS inside Syria, however, especially in the eastern part and the southeastern part, right along the border of Iraq. The policy that came out of this fight against ISIS in Iraq is very different than the policy that had driven U.S. forces in Iraq after 2003 up to the departure of U.S. forces in 2011. In 2007, there were 170,000 U.S. combat forces in Iraq, and there were 540 contract support personnel from the private sector supporting that 170,000 troops. The United States took more than 4,000 dead and more than 30,000 injured, especially in this period from 2006 to 2008 that we called the surge, to push back against the first radical uprising in Iraq that called itself Al-Qaeda. After the forces left in 2011, we restructured the way in which we dealt with the terrorist threat in Iraq. And it was something that the military calls by, with, and through. In other words, we will help attack the terrorist enemy using Iraqi forces trained and equipped and supported by American and coalition forces. And by contrast, in the 4 years of the battle against ISIS, from the gates of Baghdad through the western border being pushed into Syria, 14 coalition men and women, not all from the United States, were killed in the battle, not 4,000, but tens of thousands of Iraqi and Syrian military forces were killed. They did the real fighting. We dropped a lot of bombs on targets, but they were the ones who did the ground assault, took the territory, and defeated the caliphate as a government or proto-government that controlled territory. The problem is the ideology that lay behind ISIS has not yet been defeated. And the fact that we had to go in and destroy Hotel ISIS less than 2 months ago means that there are still parts of ISIS who are attempting to reform. And what is absolutely necessary is for forces allied with the United States and not American forces directly to continue to harass ISIS, make sure that they cannot go to ground, make sure that they cannot find places where more than three or four of them can get together regularly. This has to happen in Syria. This has to happen in northern Iraq and in western Iraq. And this has to happen in the big cities of Iraq as well. So one of my concerns is, given some of the recent decisions on the departure of American forces from Syria, I am hoping that we will be able to maintain the same kind of pressure on ISIS inside eastern Syria that did not happen in 2012 and 2013 when I was in Baghdad and we saw black flags waving across the border in Syria, but because it was across the international border, there wasn't much we could do about it. So the thing to watch now is going to be, does the Iraqi army, does the Iraqi counterterrorism service, do our Syrian allies, the Syrian Democratic Forces in Syria, have the support and the ability to continue to keep ISIS off balance so that they can maintain these small cells and maybe occasionally conduct an attack, but not organize and rise again to be a coherent organization that aims at governing territory. The second issue that's going to have a major impact on the future of Iraq is Iraq's relationship with Iran. And what happened after 2003 and the American intervention in Iraq is essentially that we decapitated Iraq. We took out the senior leadership, we dismantled the army, we took the top off the police department, we actually helped the Iraqis remove from power all of the people who had been senior members of the Ba'ath Party, the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party. These were all the people who ran the system, who knew how things worked, and while it was not unfair and they were beholden to Saddam Hussein, what we simply did is opened a huge amount of political space and a huge amount of economic space for people who we didn't really help much to move into. So what happened from 2003 onward was all of the various tribes and sects and groups and political parties and militias in Iraq began to elbow each other to try to find more space for their particular brand of politics, their particular racial or ethnic group, their particular religion, or their tribe. After U.S. forces left in 2011, we really left the field open. And during this time, especially in southern Iraq, the Iranians began to form groups that look an awful lot like Hezbollah in Lebanon, groups that come out of the Shia Islamic revolutionary ideology of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, on the pretext of protecting the unprotected Shia population of Iraq. So at first, this started to be small groups of men who were trained in arms, given some training, given small salaries, and really didn't do much but perhaps stand checkpoints and try to help secure certain areas. Over time, however, Iran has linked together these groups and has tried to use them as strategic assets inside Iraq. And in 2014, as I pointed out before, Iran and these now mostly Shia militias were one of the first sets of organizations that actually confronted ISIS militarily on the battlefield before the United States did. And that is something that is not widely known in the United States, and it is something for which Iraqis give Iran and give the Shia militias a great deal of credit. Because when the Iraqi army collapsed, when the Iraqi police collapsed, it was Shia militias and mostly Shia kids who volunteered based on the call of the religious leader Ayatollah Sistani to go to the front to protect Iraq from the threat of ISIS. It was only a couple of months later that the US came in a big way to assist the Iraqi army and the counterterrorism services. This gave the Iranian supported and trained militias that they had been working on for the past dozen years or so political legitimacy. This gave them a great deal of credibility at home, and I remember traveling in the south of Iraq And Catherine, you remember this as well. Virtually everybody I visited, every family, had somebody who was serving as a volunteer or a soldier in one of these, what they were called the popular mobilization forces. And the ladies in villages would organize rotations of food and meals and support and care packages that they would literally put in the back of pickup trucks, and they'd be driven to the front to help supply these young men who had volunteered, even though underneath the banner of an Iranian-supported militia, to fight against ISIS. So what we have now is a situation where there is a great deal of legitimacy for these organizations because of the role that they played to defend Iraqis against the surge of ISIS against Baghdad. But the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration has now begun to shrink the amount of money that is available to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Iranian Quds Force, who are the main drivers of these pro-Iranian groups in Iraq, and has made it less possible for the Iranians to provide financial support to these organizations. Now, the Iranians have wanted to continue their connections to these organizations, but they haven't been able to provide the same amount of funding, so they have essentially told these groups, you're going to have to go find money for yourself to pay your salaries and do your training and buy your weapons and your ammunition. So what the groups have begun to do is turn into criminal organizations. You have seen a large amount of checkpoints appearing on roads where just average drivers and truck drivers are stopped and shaken down for small amounts of money. We had several shipments of USAID assistance going to help internally displaced people in camps in Iraq, which were attempted to be diverted by some of these militias, and we were able to put pressure on them and get the shipments back. But it has begun now, I think, to begin the delegitimization of some of these groups as they turn more political. The last thing that I want to say is during the period of 2010 to 2014, before ISIS came in the second administration of the prime minister named Nouri al-Maliki, he began very seriously to put his political supporters, many of whom are very pro-Iranian in their orientation, but not all of them, into positions in the middle levels of the bureaucracy and government. And what you have now in Iraq is a very entrenched and often pro-Iranian set of public servants who are beginning to link Iranian strategic goals with Iraqi strategic goals. This is very much at odds with the will of the population. We'll get to that in just a moment in the third section. But what the United States has been trying to do up to this point has not been particularly effective, because we are expecting significant changes to Iraqi policy and pushback against Iran in too short a period of time. I can guarantee you that the United States is not equipped to challenge Iran on its battlefield in Iraq, because we don't conduct assassinations or kidnappings, we don't bribe people, we don't pay independent militias, we don't try to maintain control of the groups that we have trained and supported to help the Iraqi people support themselves. The two things that the United States has that Iran does not have that we need to push are economic strength, investment, and private sector, and education, both of which Iraqis actually value very highly in their very long culture. But what has to happen over the course of the next decades and generations is a pushback where Iraqis begin to understand that Iran's relationship with Iraq is quite exploitative, and that Iran is using Iraq as its strategic depth in the face of international pressure. But unfortunately, the rhetoric of the Trump administration has made it more difficult for people like me to explain to Iraqis that the United States is trying to help Iraq, we're trying to build institutions and build an economy. And as we said in the title of the group, at the title of the lecture, many Iraqis now see their situation as being stuck between Iranian pressure and American pressure. The third thing I want to talk about is the new generation of Iraqi youth. 60% of Iraqis were born after 1990, so they know nothing about Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Just over 40% of Iraqis have been born since 2000, so they really don't know much of anything about Saddam Hussein. All that they know is that the government that was supposed to be democratic and help them build a life and an economy has not succeeded in that task. They have lived through an invasion by the United States and our allies. They lived through the fight against Al-Qaeda. They've lived through the fight against ISIS. And now they're living through, over the course of the past couple of years, an economy that is growing, but not growing at the rate that the population is growing. In 2018, more than 800,000 Iraqis graduated from high school or university, and the government was able to create 42,000 jobs in very specialized areas. This might not be a big deal in the United States, but in Iraq, the government has been expected, honestly, for 5,000 years since Sumeria, to provide most of the services that people need. Iraq is a wealthy country. Iraq has got oil, it has gas, it has water, it has arable land, it has a history of education, it's got very good educational institutions, and Iraqis are, by and large, very hardworking. So all of the ingredients are there for the Iraqi economy to grow and expand and provide a better well-being for its population. But historically, the Iraqi economy has been horribly mismanaged, and particularly over the past decade, the economy has been mismanaged. And I'd like to tell you a second story, which I think encapsulates what many young Iraqis are going through. This story was relayed to me in my first tour in Iraq almost a decade ago by one of the governors of one of the provinces of southern Iraq. And he heard this story because every week, like a good Arab leader, he opened his office for people to bring in their petitions to tell them about their problems and ask him for assistance. So he told me that one day during one of these sessions, a young man named Muhammad came to him and told him this story. "Mr. Governor, my father owned a car repair shop in a village in southern Iraq. We were the first of six almost identical shops on the row on the street. And then my father died when I was 17. I had to quit school and take over the business. But luckily, I was a better businessman than my father, and I repaired the cars better, and I got more customers. So when the man who owned the second shop in the row decided he was going to retire, and his sons did not want to take over the business, I negotiated with him, and I took over his repair stall. That was great. I was making a lot of money. I had a lot of new clients, and I was able to hire all of my cousins as mechanics. Life was good. In fact, I was making so much money, I was able to put some aside, and then I bought the third shop in a row from its owner. And I was in my early 20s, and I owned half of the car repair shops in my town. I could not believe my success. I was making money hand over fist, but I had run out of cousins. I didn't have any more mechanics. So I advertised for car mechanics. And that's when my problems began. So a few days after putting out the ad, a knock on his door, a representative of the local militia. "Muhammad, we are very happy that a local boy has been so successful in his business. It would be a shame if anything were to happen to your business. But we would like to help you protect it for only 10% of your profits." So, "Mr. Governor," I paid them the money. Then a few weeks later, I got another knock at my door. It was the local director of the Ministry of Electricity. And he came in and said, "Muhammad, we are so happy for your success. I want to let you know that your father hadn't paid an electric bill for the past 34 years. Here are all the bills." He threw a stack of paper down on my desk and said, "I know you can't afford that much, but if you give me half, I'll take care of them for you." Then a couple weeks later, from the water ministry, from the city saying that his shop was no longer under the code. "Mr. Governor, they took all my money. I have no business. I can't support my family. What am I supposed to do?" What this story illustrates is what those 800,000 young Iraqis who entered the labor force last year are learning. If they cannot get a government job, not only does the government stand in the way of their ability to create their own business and create wealth and jobs, the society has not supported it, and there are militias and criminal gangs that push back on them constantly. What you are reading about, if you've been reading over the past 5 weeks, is a series of demonstrations that has happened in Lebanon, but also now in Iraq, in Baghdad and neighborhoods and towns all the way south to the border of Iran and almost to the border of Kuwait, to the larger city of Basra. And what is interesting about these demonstrations, which are currently going on, this is the Shia majority heartland of Iraq. About 60% of Iraqis identify themselves as Shia. Some are tribal and live in the countryside. Some live in cities or small towns. But it's increasingly clear to them that the Shia-led government in Baghdad has been unable and in many ways is unwilling to open the economy to permit them to succeed. And what you have seen in the past month is tens of thousands of young Iraqis not identifying as Shia, as identifying as Iraqis who don't have any economic opportunities, protesting in the streets, calling for, first of all, services, electricity, water, and to some extent jobs. But as people in the security services fired on the crowd, killed more demonstrators, the calls for a larger reform of Iraq, including a change to the electoral system, a change of the government, a change in the way that the economy is run, are getting higher and higher. So I'm not quite sure where this is going to end, because I have been reading on my WhatsApp group with some of my friends in Iraq day to day what is actually happening on the ground. But Iraq may be going through, I guess, the echo of what we called the Arab Spring about 10 years ago in other parts of the Arab world. There is a large part of Arab youth in Iraq that now believe that the government and the system that is in place is not working for them. What is also interesting about these demonstrations is that almost nobody other than Shia youth are participating. In the Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad, they've been pretty quiet. In the Sunni areas of the west and the north, there have been very few demonstrations, a couple in solidarity for the larger demonstrations, but without a lot of real demands on their own. Among the Christian community or the Yazidi community, there have been editorials and speeches praising what the demonstrators are doing, but no upswell. And in the Kurdish region, frankly, the Kurds are focusing much more on what's going on next door in Syria than they are what is going on inside Iraq in the south. So what I find interesting about this is that many Shia believe that after the United States came into Iraq in 2003, we essentially brought Iraq back to its rightful place, a country that is majority Shia, run by Shia. And I think that the Shia have been particularly disturbed that the people that they have put in political leadership have absolutely and utterly failed to meet the demands of the people. The last thing I want to talk about is a little bit about what I'm doing now. I retired from the Foreign Service, as George said, about 6 months ago. And I've been very fortunate to land at the head of a small nonprofit that focuses narrowly and deeply on the events and the culture and the arts and the society of the Gulf states and the states around them that have great influence, Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and those countries that buy their oil, that invest in their economies, China, India, Europe, the United States. I'm infinitely fortunate to have this opportunity. And what I was going to tell all of you is if anything that I have said is interesting, I would ask you, if you're interested in reading more, to go to my organization's website. It's Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. I've got a bunch of cards here because it's a difficult acronym to remember, but it's www.agsiw.org. Because every week we publish three or four short papers, 1,000 to 1,500 words, on very interesting topics. If you want to know what has happened when Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, has lifted restrictions on women being able to get passports and travel without the permission of their husbands or brothers or sons or parents, we've written about it. If you want to hear or see a little bit more about sort of an objective rendering of the effect of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, we have written about that. If you want to hear about Iran's use of blockchain and cryptocurrencies to try to evade American sanctions, we've written about that. If you want to hear about what has happened with the attacks on Saudi Arabia or shipping in the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Sea, we've written about that. So all of these things which are now in the news, we have written about, and we have very good objective scholars who write factual reports. We try very hard to avoid editorializing, although we have editorialized by declaring that a war between the United States and Iran would not be a good thing. So we've gone way out on the limb on that one. Thank you very much. What I meant to do today is not tell you that Iraq is going to be fine, that everything's good, that there is a solution, or rather, everything is going to fall apart. What I wanted to lay out for you is the three areas that I think the United States and interested Americans need to watch so we can evaluate whether our government, whether our allies, whether the Iraqi government are actually making progress. And again, we need to make sure that ISIS doesn't come back, because it is a virulent ideology that has done truly horrific things in the region. We need to make sure that we are pushing back on Iran and Iran's influence in the region and in Iraq, but in a way that is effective, and I'm afraid that that's probably a long-term project. And then third, we need to watch what is going to happen to this large youth bulge in Iraq, because Iraq is a wealthy country, but it stifles entrepreneurship and it stifles the creativity of this very large and growing youth population. If that can be unleashed, Iraq will probably be all right. If the economy continues to be constrained and controlled by Baghdad, it's going to be much more difficult. So, gives you some food for thought.
I want to thank you very much. Gives us a whole lot to think about, and there's a lot of, we'll move this forward a little so we can get okay. These questions up here. I always take, while we're collecting questions from the members and their guests, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question. It's the prerogative of the moderator. As I listened to what you're talking about, I heard a very unstable Iraq. That the political situation hasn't really settled down, that there's a lot of unrest among the youth, all of the things you've said. Is Iraq, how is it going to get to a stable situation where, for example, if I were want to invest in Iraq, I could be somewhat confident that my investment isn't just lost?
First of all, I have to say, George, it's a very good question, because I have uncharacteristically painted a glass half empty picture of Iraq. As somebody who first went there in 2006 for a little while and then spent, as I said, 5 of the past 10 years there, I have seen great improvements in security. Iraq's oil production has gone up significantly. It's now the second largest oil producer in OPEC. They have, I think, the second or third largest reserves in OPEC, and they've done this mostly on their own without a lot of foreign assistance. Baghdad is now a safe city. There is nightlife, people are going out to restaurants, there are 5 or 6 big fancy malls in the city. You're increasingly seeing fancy cars driving around. So life in Baghdad and in most of the major cities had more or less returned to normal until about 6 weeks ago when these demonstrations started, and probably would have stayed fairly peaceful if early in the demonstrations there had not been deaths among the demonstrators, and the cause of the deaths is still a question of great debate. So I didn't want to say that there has not been progress in Iraq, but I think there has. Maybe more interestingly, and especially under young Iraqis, there is still a deep and abiding faith that democracy and the ability of people to choose their leaders, as long as they can find a system where those leaders are forced to account, is the way that Iraq should go in the future. And I was surprised that I heard that over and over again from all of the communities. And this is one of the chief demands that you find in the demands of these crowds. So even in the face of instability and economic problems, many in Iraq are not looking to rip down the whole system and start over again, but rather reform it in a way that will permit democracy and, to a lesser extent, a free market economy take over. So that's the glass half full interpretation. But I also recommended to George, and you'll see on the literature that you got when you were invited to this, there is an article by a woman at RAND Corporation named Linda Robinson, who's a journalist and a researcher who has worked mostly on military issues. And she wrote in Foreign Affairs magazine, I think the September-October issue, one of the few glass-half-full articles that I have seen on Iraq in the past decade. And one of the reasons that I wanted you to read that as an introduction or perhaps as a follow-up to this talk is to understand that there really are opportunities and there are things that can happen to help ensure that Iraq turns out more stable, more prosperous, and hopefully more democratic and happier.
Thank you. Here's one on how the information we're getting from Iraq is handled. Do you feel the U.S. and international media have done a good job in covering developments in Iraq? Could you cite any examples of particularly good or bad reporting? Ooh. What about the information we're getting?
To be perfectly honest, there is so much going on in the world aside Iraq that the international parts of the newspapers, and I read every morning the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and go through a number of other websites, it's hard to find information on Iraq because it is crowded out, first of all, by the politics of Washington and the polarization of the United States, which is the largest piece of everybody's news. I am finding that I get much of my breaking news and a lot of my factual news from a WhatsApp group that I have with a bunch of friends who are currently in Europe, in Iraq, in different parts of Iraq. I like the WhatsApp group because somebody will say, someone just sent me this video of somebody shooting a protester in Tahrir Square in Baghdad, and somebody else will say, that's wrong, I saw that. That's Lebanon, I know that street in Lebanon, this happened 10 years ago, this is fake news. Or as happened this morning, there were other reports of the same thing. They said, oh my goodness, this looks real, this appears to be a legitimate act of violence by somebody against demonstrators just this morning. So it is, if you will, a self-regulating WhatsApp group in English and in Arabic where people try to get together and figure out what is happening in their own country, and I'm honored to actually be a part of that so that I can help evaluate it. But there are so many things, protests in Hong Kong, protests in Lebanon. I'm not even going to go through the whole list of things that are going, that are being difficult in the world right now. It's hard to get good, objective information. And again, that's one of the reasons I suggested that everybody read the Linda Robinson piece in Foreign Affairs, because it was a calmer, more considered approach to Iraq in the face of all of the noise that we're hearing from other places. That doesn't really help you get good news, because I guess I could forward you some of my WhatsApp feed.
But part of it is what we should be reading or what range of things we should be reading to really learn more about what's going on. There were several questions here about the Iraqi Kurds and the situation there. In particular, what has been the impact of recent events in Syria on the Kurdish-Arab relations in Iraq? Has it affected separatist sentiments among the Kurds? What's happening up there in northern Iraq?
I purposely didn't address the Kurdish population in my remarks because I figured somebody would ask.
Several someones.
The one thing that I will say about Kurds in general is although they identify as the Kurds, in reality, it's a very divided group. They're divided by language, they're divided by national borders, they're divided by tribal affiliations, and there is a loose emotional tie among Kurds. But what has happened in Syria recently with the announcement by President Trump that the Turks would go into northeastern Syria to push the Kurds back from the border has triggered a very deep emotional response across northern Iraq, and I presume among Kurds in Syria and probably Iran and in Turkey as well, because there is beginning to be, according to some of my Kurdish friends, pressure from the population on the Iraqi Kurdish leadership to do more to help their brethren in eastern Syria. Now, already in northern Iraq, the Kurdistan Regional Government, the semi-autonomous part of the country run by the Kurds, is the largest supporter of both refugees, mostly from Syria and largely Kurds, and of internally displaced Iraqis, Christians, Yazidis, Sunnis, who were displaced by ISIS and have not yet gone home. So they bear a fairly large economic and social burden by hosting hundreds of thousands of refugees and internally displaced people on their territory. What concerns me the most is not necessarily a change in a desire by Kurds to move toward independence. I think that's probably that's been around for a long time and will probably continue until the Kurds actually achieve that. What concerns me is the Kurds' opinion of the United States and our ability to continue what has been a very close and very cooperative political, economic, and military relationship, at least the Kurds of northern Iraq. And even before I left, many Kurds were telling me that we're not entirely sure that the United States is as reliable as an ally as it used to be, and we're going to hedge our bets and do more with Iran and do more with Turkey to make sure that we stay safe. So I think that probably what the biggest result of the policy in northeastern Syria and the pullback of American forces and what the Kurds see as the abandonment of the Kurdish part of the Syrian Democratic Forces is going to be Kurds in Iraq and elsewhere in the region hedging their bets and making sure that they have alliances and ties and connections to a broader range of people so that they will not have to rely solely on the United States for political or economic or military support.
Then there's also several questions here, as you might imagine, about the relationship between the Sunnis and the Shia. What is the relationship in Iraq between the two? And can Iraq ever exist as a united country?
That's two doctoral dissertations. So any students that are out there would like to take one of those on as your master's thesis or doctoral dissertation. The answer is, unfortunately, it depends. Because the division between Sunnis and Shia, the religious differences, are not the only fissure in Iraqi society. There is also a fissure between urban Iraqis and rural, often tribal Iraqis. And that doesn't break down cleanly along Sunni and Shia lines, but there tend to be more Shia in the cities and more Sunnis in tribal areas. So there is also a legacy, especially of Saddam Hussein and the monarchy period of Iraq in cities, that intermarriages are a good thing. So of my generation, there are many people I know where a Sunni is married to a Shia or a Christian is married to a Shia. And this was very common in the past. And I think that the religious and ethnic differences, Saddam tried to repress them and tried to make people create what his vision of was a non-sectarian new Iraq. Some of that still exists. And in cities like Baghdad, where there are large populations of both Sunni and Shia, you still see interaction and you see intermarriage, just less than in the past. However, from the side of many Shia politicians and many average Shia in the street, they have seen the experience of the rise of Al-Qaeda and then the rise of ISIS over the past decade and said, what's with these Sunnis? They're trying to destroy us. We can't trust them. And I think that this is the beginning, again, of a greater social division or societal division between Sunnis and Shias, which I think will take some time to heal if it can be healed. There is another geographic aspect to this, which is also religious. For the past 5 years, as the Iraqi army and security forces were fighting ISIS, They withdrew most of the police and most of the army that provided security in the south of Iraq to the north and the west to be on the front lines against ISIS. So what has happened in the south of Iraq is that militias, some Iranian-sponsored, some that sprung up from volunteers returning from the war, in some cases just kids with Kalashnikovs, got together, created gangs, and started running their neighborhoods or their villages or their towns. And this is another thing that has contributed to the demonstrations that we've seen in the south. Because after the defeat of ISIS, the government and the international community focused on how do we rebuild the part of Iraq that was destroyed by ISIS. And there was a lot of focus on projects and money going to the north and the west and the Christian areas and the Sunni areas and the city of Mosul. People in Basra in the far south say, we produce 85% of the wealth of this country within 50 miles of our city. Why are we not getting any of this money? For the past 4 years, people have told us that you can't have investment money for your cities and your villages because we need that money to fight ISIS. Now that ISIS is defeated, we're owed a big debt of investment from the south. So again, this is another issue that is not necessarily sectarian, but it is definitely geographic, and it might help exacerbate those Sunni-Shia tensions.
Well, thank you. We've been talking about the economy and the politics. Let's turn to the military now.
Okay.
Can you characterize Iraq's military? Has it rebounded since disbanded after the 2003 invasion under stable military, civilian control? You know, what's the situation?
I will say that I have been very pleased in my last tour, the last 2.5-3 years in Iraq, with the increased professionalism of the Iraqi military. I think that between 2003 and 2011, the United States, and especially the US military, tried to get the Iraqis to do things our way, which are admittedly good and powerful and often very efficient and effective, but didn't always fit with Iraqi culture, Iraqi society, and the way that Iraqis do things. Since 2011, as I said, our strategy has shifted to dealing with military and security problems by, with, and through Iraqi security forces. And our focus has been on training, support, how the Iraqis can develop intelligence networks inside their country to figure out who the bad guys are, both either criminal or terrorist, how they then take and collect that information and analyze it, and then how they turn that into planning for a law enforcement or military action. I've also been pretty impressed by the ability of the Iraqi army and counterterrorism service and police to keep ISIS on the run since 2017. They have conducted numerous sweeps of all the desert areas in the west and in the north. They have done a lot of things around Baghdad and even south of Baghdad when ISIS tried to do an end run and kind of go around Baghdad and come up from the south. So they are doing a better job. The kinds of things that they did not do in 2012 and 2013 that might have prevented ISIS from coming across the border from Syria into Iraq. So I have much greater confidence that they are more professional, they are more committed. What I want to make sure is that the United States and our coalition partners continue to help support this, if nothing else, through training and mentoring, which has probably helped to rebuild the very damaged esprit de corps of the Iraqi army that had crumbled in 2014 in the face of ISIS. So I am cautiously optimistic about the abilities of the Iraqi security forces. I am concerned that many of them may have been involved in deaths of protesters over the course of the past 5 weeks, which is very much against the training that we had provided and the new ethos of the military. And it'll be also interesting to see how Iraqis in the military deal with those problems.
We've talked about all these elements, and you yourself had in your presentation talked about comparing this, the current demonstrations and all, with the Arab uprising. So the question is, do you see the Iraqi war as a failed experiment to democratize the Middle East? Is this just another one of these Arab Spring type situations that it's going to lead to nothing?
There are very few people in Iraq who argue that getting rid of Saddam Hussein was a bad idea. There are a few people who profited greatly from the Ba'ath regime and his rule, but the vast majority of the country was happy to see him gone. That has not, however, translated into a sense of gratitude toward the United States and other coalition partners, because what has come after that invasion has been not as productive, not as addressing of the people's needs as folks had wanted. I want to go back a little bit to American history, because if you look at the history of the United States, starting in 1776, 13 colonies declared independence, and it wasn't until 1789 that we even unified under a constitution, which wasn't ratified for some time after that. And it was probably not until British forces burned the White House when they invaded Washington during the War of 1812 that Americans began to feel like Americans. That's a span of nearly 40 years from independence to the first ideas that this is a republic that can hang together despite our differences. Iraq is not dissimilar to the United States. It's a widely varied population in education, economic background, religion, ethnicity, and it's a very large country that works relatively well as an economic unit. So what I have seen now, having gone through several Iraqi election cycles, is that Iraqis' faith in democracy has still remained, even though faith in the governments that they have elected has been shaken in many occasions. I think it's going to take a couple more Iraqi election cycles before something begins to work and you begin to see Sunni and Shia political parties running on a platform with each other on a separate message. It may take another election cycle before you see a majority government. All the Iraqi governments since 2003 have been, I guess what they call in Israel, a government of national unity, where everybody's in the government. But the problem with that is when everybody's in the government, nobody's in the government. This past election cycle, they had two blocs that were seeking to get a clear majority so they could implement their programs. One was probably very favorable to the United States, and the other would have been very unfavorable to the United States. But neither one succeeded, so they ended up allying, and that's one of the reasons that you see the current problems, because they went back to the old model where the government is unable to accomplish anything because somebody who's theoretically in the government disagrees. I think patience is going to be necessary, continued support and mentoring, and probably the help of people like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to help the Iraqis take concrete steps on the economy to get this, to let the calmness and development of politics in Iraq last a bit longer until it begins to take hold.
Well, you kind of led into this with your following, your last comments, but even if the government, Iraqi government, reforms or is able to advance the economy, isn't the sheer size of the youth population ensure the frustration contains? Aren't there just too many people, too few jobs, you can't create enough jobs? How do you address that problem that you had flagged in your
The question is exactly right. The problem is for the modern history of Iraq, and frankly the ancient history of Iraq, when there have been governments, the government has provided jobs to people. And you were either a farmer or a government employer. And the government allocated the farmers their land, so to some extent they were also dependent upon the government. What has to happen in Iraq is to take the economy out of the hands of the Iraqi government. And this is going to be very difficult to do because it really is the idea of centralized government. One of the places where the idea of centralized government developed 5,000 years ago is the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And this is modern-day Iraq. Modern-day Iraq still uses the aqueducts and the irrigation system that were dug 5,000 years ago by Sumerians and other civilizations in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. Modern Iraqi Arabic is cut through with expressions and words from Sumerian. Even part of the grammar of Iraqi Arabic is Sumerian. There is a lot of the weight of history that makes Iraqis believe that their government should be responsible for all of the things that they need: education, healthcare, electricity, water, even jobs in the future. And the reality is, with a population that is now exploding, Iraq's population, if it hasn't passed 40 million this week, it will by the end of the year. It was 23 million in 2003. the government is unable, no matter how much oil they produce, to provide a job to everybody. And the reality is that the provision of jobs over the past decade is what has destroyed the economy. Because as you heard in the example of the story of the kid Muhammad who ran his, took over his father's car repair shop, it was government officials who have really bad, low-paying jobs who use their authority to extract money out of the economy and make it more difficult for entrepreneurs to actually operate. We have been working, the United States has been working, to try to help slowly and rationally deregulate the Iraqi economy. The idea of socialism, that the government will own the major means of production, at least of oil and gas, is probably not going to go away for generations. But there is still an Iraqi tradition of entrepreneurship and small businesses. It's just that the government now really gets in the way of small business. You can provide jobs for 1 million new Iraqis a year if you let people create their own jobs and try to make sure that corruption and government regulation don't get in the way of those jobs. So I think the solution is deregulation as quickly as possible, but rationally as possible. It's just that when you deregulate, then the director of the water ministry and the electricity ministry don't get the money that they would have gotten, so you're breaking people's rice bowls. So there's a lot of pushback in the bureaucracy. But this is the solution, and whether or not Iraq can do that, or is even willing to try, will probably determine the success of their republic going forward.
And we've got a few minutes, and let me just close with one question that's very general, and then I'm going to do one that's a little more political in nature. The more general question is, when all is said and done, is the average Iraqi better off today than they were in 2003?
Again, it depends upon where you are and what your station is. One statistic I think that Americans are not aware of is that in 2003, when the U.S. intervened, there were probably 1.5 million Christians in Iraq. Today, that population is probably closer to 250,000. Because when we removed Saddam Hussein, we removed the political actor who worked very hard to protect the minorities of the country, and they provided him support. So for Christians, for Yazidis, for Sabian Mandians, and other groups, Saddam Hussein worked very hard to make sure that those communities were not harassed, they got their share of investment, they got their share of government jobs, even if they were limited in how high they could go. So if you are a Christian, you're probably worse off. And what has happened now inside communities and families in Iraq, especially in the Christian community, which was always better educated and more affluent than the average Iraqi, you have families split. Because one part of the family will say, we cannot lose Christianity here in the Holy Land. I visited the tomb of the Old Testament prophet Nahum. If you go to your Old Testaments and read the book of the prophet Nahum, he is from a village in northern Iraq called Al-Kosh, and he is buried there, and your taxpayer dollars and Czech taxpayer dollars are paying to keep his tomb from crumbling because it's a very important historical and religious place. There is deep history of many of these communities inside Iraq, and many people don't want to lose that connection to the land. But in the same family, my daughter is really smart. She's great in science. If I immigrate to Adelaide, she can go to medical school and live in Australia and have a much better life than she's going to have here in Iraq. So families, communities, even religious figures are caught between, should our priority be preserving Christianity in Iraq, or should it be creating a better life for our communities, which may not be inside Iraq, it may be in Germany or Canada or Australia or someplace else around the world. One example where the unintended consequences of the intervention in 2003 have created problems that didn't exist before. If you are a pro-Iranian militia leader, you're doing much better than you did before 2003. But frankly, Iraq is now wealthier than it was before 2003. Iraq is producing far more oil. The government is spending more on public services. It's just that the population is growing so fast, they're unable to keep up with the population growth with the inefficient and corrupt government that has developed. So the answer is, it depends. But for many people, 2003 is not has created more problems.
And let's end one on maybe a little more personal note, and that is you're recently retired from the Department of State. Would you comment on the state of the department? Is it healthy? Is everyone being kicked out like we hear? Or what's happening?
The answer is there is a real morale crisis in the State Department. I will say that a good friend of mine is Masha Yovanovitch. Everybody calls her Marie, but she goes by Masha. One of the nicest, most decent people I've ever met. When I was in Turkey and was temporarily in charge, she came down from Armenia, where she was the ambassador then, and we sat around my dinner table and tried to find ways to help Turks and Armenians wrestle with the question of the Armenian genocide and how do we stop what has been a cultural war between the two sides and historical war between the two sides since the end of World War I. What I see in the White House and this administration is the rejection of expertise and the rejection of experience. The reality is, however, the way our system is structured, the certificate I got that was signed twice by Barack Obama and not by Donald Trump, said that I serve, quote unquote, during the pleasure of the president. So it is well within the right of the president to decide that he does not want person A as an ambassador in this position, would rather have person B. I have no problem with that. What concerns me is that many senior people, like myself, have left the department because very few opportunities have been made available to us. And I think that I'm confident because I know the quality of the people who are right behind us in the system. And I don't despair of the system. I think that it will come back together when and if the American people begin to find agreement that there is, in fact, objective truth, that expertise actually matters, and that you can determine what a fact is and act on a fact as opposed to a hunch. This has been a problem with all administrations. To be perfectly honest, all administrations come in with a particular political view. It's just that this one is a bit more extreme than the other ones I've worked for, and this is the sixth president for whom I worked.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. And we can't let you leave without giving you one of the much coveted Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug, so that you can have your coffee out of a great mug.
I'm quite sure there's no one else in my office who has one of those. I appreciate it. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.